Please join me in saying the Anna Bekoach. Anna Bekoach, Gedulach Shemitah, Shalat Yantir, Tzedir Tzeduah, Aleph Bet Gimel Yud Tav Tzadi, Kabel Rinat, Amcha Sagvel
Rinat,
Tarenu, No
Rain, No
Nagibor, Dor Shehu, Barchem Tacharem. Betet Resh Tzadi Tav Gimel Chasin Kadosh Berav
Tuvcha Nael Kadacha.
Chet Kuf Bet Tet Nunayan Yachid Geh Lamcha Penei Zohrei Kiddushatav Yudim Lamed Nezakav Shavateinu Kabel Ushma Tziakateinu Yodeinu Yodeinu Shin Kufav Tzadi Yudtav. The Tav that created the planet Lavana, the moon, and the Chet that created the constellation Sartan, the sign of the crab, also known as the sign of cancer. And it also created the month of Tammuz. In the eighth verse, we say in a whisper, but I will say it out loud for the purposes of teaching. Baruch Shem Kivod Malchuto Leolam Vayed. Welcome to the Hilulah of Rashi. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, truly his name is actually Rabbi Shlomo Ben Yitzhak, but he is known by many different names associated with the initials of his name. And the most famous, of course, is Rashi, Resh for the word rabbi, and Shlomo, Shin for his name Shlomo, and Yud for Yitzhak, his father's name. And putting those three together, you get the word Rashi.
That's good.
I'm sorry?
That's good. I'm replying to that. That's good.
Okay. And as we've spoken about on Thursday night when we were talking at the Hilulah of Yosef HaSadiq, it is good to light a candle to connect with the soul of the person who left, the Sadiq who left. And it can be a 25-hour candle or a 7-day candle, whichever you prefer. For important tzaddikim like Rashi, and in a few minutes you'll understand why he's important. I light 7-day candles, and on other days I light the... or for other tzaddikim, I light the 25-hour candle. Uh, I'm actually just going to read his biography and information about him initially from the Wikipedia. And it's just, I felt it was somewhat easiest to have that discussion before we talked about other issues, but as a general discussion before I start his biography. Rashi is the foremost commentator on the Bible, the Talmud, the Tanakh, actually. He has made commentary verse by verse on almost every part of the Jewish background. And this is why he is considered so famous, and why he is studied from the beginning of time, from the beginning of his time, from the beginning of when things were printed. And he's actually famous for something called the Rashi script. The Rashi script is a font of the Hebrew language. When the printing press first came out, the way the letters were printed, whatever language it was being printed in, whatever letters were basically made as impressions or reverse impressions with lead type. And it was expensive to make, and it was expensive to put into the proper order so that people could read the typeface when it printed. And so there was a movement, and the first person who printed the Hebrew commentaries, I don't remember his name, he developed a font that took less lead and therefore was less expensive to produce. And he called it the Rashi script. And that has become famous to the point where in order to study these commentaries, you have to be able to read this font, which is somewhat similar to the Hebrew letters, but it's different. And it's sometimes hard to follow it until you have a basic background in it. Over the last 20, 30 years with the advent of the personal computer and the change from typesetting to the different technologies in printing today, there's a less of a demand for Rashi script. But you will still pick up books that are printed this way just out of tradition. One of the amazing things of Jewish people is they follow tradition, sometimes not knowing why. One of the most famous aspects to me of what is a problem in following tradition actually came out of the same idea with the printing press, and that's the eight-letter name of the Tetragrammaton interchanged with the Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, with Adonai. So those eight letters have always been intermixed as Yud, Aleph, Hey, Dalet, Vav, Nun, and then Hey, Yud. So the first and last letter were Yuds. And to save typing, to save the cost, the printers printed what everybody knew was an eight-letter name. They printed it as Yud, Yud. And so you will sometimes see in the printing that that's the way the name is printed, Yud Yud, and everybody knows to pronounce it Adonai, because it is the Tetragrammaton mixed with the Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. But in our generation, after 400, 500 years, we don't know that anymore. And people just are taught Yud Yud means God, means Adonai. They don't realize where its source comes from. And this is the problem with tradition, because traditions do not pass down all aspects of what the tradition represents. So let me light the candle for Rashi. Rabbi Yitzhak Shlomo, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzhak, b'zchut agen aleinu. And I will start by reading from Wikipedia. Shlomo Yitzhaki, or Isaac Seitz, and better known by the acronym Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, February 22nd, 1940, to July, excuse me, 1040, to July 13th of 1105. So he died in the 65th year. 65 is the gematria of Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, the name of God in the physical world, the name we pronounce Adonai when we see the Tetragrammaton. Was a medieval French rabbi, famed as the author of a comprehensive commentary on the Talmud, as well as a comprehensive commentary on the Tanakh. He is considered the father of all commentaries that followed on the Talmud. The next comprehensive commentary came out of what a group of rabbis called the Baalei Tosafot. They came out of northern France, which is where Rashi was teaching. And so he's more than likely started this group. And they commented on his comments, including his grandson. Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam, the grandson of Rashi, one of the Baalei Tosafot, they have a mechlochet for the sake of heaven over the order that the parchments are placed in the head tefillin. And there are some nice stories about that having to do with who is right. And one of the rabbis went up to heaven to inquire as to which was the correct approach. And the answer that came back is, we're still discussing it in heaven. And so the resolution of that is, there are many different minhagims, many different customs, but one of the more famous ones associated with the Hasidic movement, and the one that I follow myself, which is to wear the Rashi style of tefillin every day, and the Rabbeinu Tam immediately afterward. And that is only for people who have become married. If you are not married under religious law, under halakha, then you would not have access to the Rabbeinu Tam, or should not utilize the Rabbeinu Tam. It's only for those people who have reached a level of consciousness that allows them to be married, which is a whole different discussion, because people think that you get married because it's time to get married. But you meet the right person, your parents arrange the right shidduch, whatever the approach is. And it really has to do with the consciousness of your soul that has drawn the person into your life. And that level, that relationship, is related to the Rabbeinu Tam head tefillin. And that energy is drawn by when it's placed. Now, it has become, in the Sephardic community, it has become a, and the Kabbalistic community, it has become a minhag to wear both tefillin at the same time, but to wear your talit over them so that people cannot see them and whisper about you that you have a big head, because you're wearing both styles at the same time. And it's it avoids gossip. There are many reasons why that came about, and it's very valid, because it the only people who have the authority to wear both at the same time are those people who are either very close to being Kabbalists or who are Kabbalists themselves. Anyway, I've been sidetracked, which is very good and very normal. Continuing to read. I should mention, the Baalei Tosafot made comprehensive commentary on the Talmud, but the Ramban, Ibn Ezra, the Or Chaim, and other rabbis, they made it on the Tanakh. But generally speaking, nobody has, or I'm not aware of anybody, I'm sure there are, who have made commentaries on both the Talmud and the Tanakh. Acclaimed for his ability to present the basic meaning of the text in a concise yet lucid fashion, Rashi appeals to both learned scholars and beginning students, and his works remain a centerpiece of contemporary Jewish study. His commentary on the Talmud, which covers nearly all of the Babylonian Talmud, a total of 30 tractates, has been included in every edition of the Talmud since its first printing by Daniel Bornberg in the 1520s. So it must be Daniel Bornberg who created the Rashi script. His commentary on Tanakh, especially his commentary on the Chumash, is an indispensable aid to students of all levels. The latter commentary alone serves as the basis for more than 300 super commentaries, which analyze Rashi's choice of language and citations, penned by some of the greatest names in rabbinic literature. Rashi's surname, Yitzhaki, derives from his father's name, Yitzhak. The acronym is sometimes also fancifully expanded as Rabban Shel Yisrael, the teacher of Israel, or as Rabbeinu Shechiyeh, our rabbi, may he live. There is one other discussion I want to mention before I continue. Rashi's commentary is very unusual. In fact, it's frequently known. It's frequently known that when you read Rashi's commentary, it confuses the verse even more. It's difficult to understand what he's saying because he's writing a quick note to explain something in the verse. And that quick note assumes that you have some background. And the Kabbalist, over the last 500 years since the Ari, they have indicated that Rashi must have been a Kabbalist. He must have been aware of the Zohar, because with the knowledge of the Zohar, his comments that are confusing become clear. And this Mechlochet, this argument, has been going on for a long time, if 500 years or more. Because the Zohar was revealed in Spain in the year 1170. So, if Rashi passed in 1105, how could he have seen the Zohar? Because, according to the academics, the Zohar was not written until 1170, when Rabbi Moshe de Leon in Spain released it. The Kabbalists say it was written by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, and there has never been a working Kabbalist who has said otherwise. I should retract that, because um, Well, maybe not. Let's let it stand. So the question is, could Rashi have received a copy of the Zohar, assuming it was written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which the academics are so certain it could not have been? Did he have a copy of it? Could he have had a copy of it in northern France 200 years, 100 years, 65 years earlier than his reputed leaving or the reputed release of the Zohar? So this discussion has been going on, this argument, this machloket, because people are searching for truth. And Rashi is well known, and he is the guy. You read him, and you have to be able to relate to his commentaries or dispute his commentaries, which some people have done. But this is all part of the process of searching for truth. But is Rashi aware of the Zohar is the question. He may not have been a Kabbalist, but is he aware of the Zohar? And it's interesting to note that historically there is one verse from the Zohar written on his original papers. And of course, naturally, the Kabbalists say that's his handwriting. He must have known about the Zohar. And the academics say it must have been somebody who got the papers later. So ultimately, we have a phrase that says, leave this to Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet. When he returns, he'll relate to us what is the truth about this subject, this question, if it's truly important. Is it just a curiosity that makes us busy with the Satan and wasting our time, as I have just done for 5 minutes, Bli Ayin Hara? Or is it a real subject that is important in the process of connecting to the Creator? I'll leave that to my listeners to answer. Continuing with the biography. Rashi was an only child born at Troyes, Champagne in northern France. His mother's brother was Simon the Elder, the rabbi of Mainz. Mainz, by the way, is in Germany. Shimon was a disciple of Rabbeinu Gershom, Maor HaGolah, who died that same year on his father's side. Rashi has been claimed to be a 33rd generation descendant of Yochanan HaSandler, who was a 4th generation descendant of Gamaliel the Elder, who was reputedly descended from the royal house of King David the Great. In his voluminous writings, Rashi himself made no such claim at all. The main early rabbinical source about his ancestry, Responsum number 29 by Solomon Luria, make no such claim either. It is important if Rashi is a descendant of King David, because then we would assume that he is the Mashiach of his generation. Other than that, it's a totally meaningless issue, because he is who he is. His writings speak for themselves. And he is this famous rabbi who chose to leave, and I forgot to mention this or didn't mention it yet, who chose to leave tonight and tomorrow, which is the 29th day of the month of Tammuz. Tammuz generally does not have 30 days. We have enough with the 3-week period of energy that we don't need another day. We don't need the 30th day. Generally, there's not 30 days in Tammuz. In the 19-year cycle of the Hebrew calendar, I think there's 1 or 2 years that Tammuz has 30 days. But why would he have chosen to leave? As I've said before, the Tzaddikim choose to leave. They know they have to leave because until our generation, where we have this choice, it was not acceptable for people to live thousands of years, hundreds of years. It would have destroyed our free choice for choosing good and evil. And so the idea that he chose to pass this day. Now, why this particular day? He knew that Joseph HaTzaddik had passed on the 27th, the 10th day. His day is the 12th day. 12th, there's 21 days in the period, 3 weeks. Half of 3 weeks is 10 and a half. So it's not that. Why would he have passed on the 12th day? Well, there are 12 tribes in Israel. And when we come to Rabbi Isaac Luria, who passed on the 5th of Av, we understand why he passed, because he was dealing with the Sefirot, and he passed on Hod Shebachod, which I'll explain on that day. But the 12th day, I believe, represents the Tetragrammaton on the right, four letters, the Tetragrammaton on the left, four letters, and the Tetragrammaton in the center, four letters, for a total of 12 letters, which is why there are 12 tribes of Israel and why there are 12 zodiac signs, having to do with the Tree of Life. And I believe that is why he left today. Okay, his name later made him the subject of many legends. One tradition contends that his parents were childless for many years. Rashi's father Yitzhak, a poor vintner, he made wine, once found a precious jewel and was approached by non-Jews who wished to buy it to adorn their idol. Yitzhak agreed to travel with them to their land, but en route he cast the gem into the sea. Afterwards he was visited either by a bat kol, a heavenly voice, or the prophet Elijah, who told him that he would be rewarded with the birth of a noble son who would illuminate the world with his Torah knowledge. Legend also states that the couple moved to Worms, Germany, while Rashi's mother was expecting. As she walked down one of the narrow streets in the Jewish quarter, she was imperiled by two oncoming carriages. She turned and pressed herself against the wall, which opened to receive her. This miraculous niche is still visible in the wall of the Rashi Shul. That's something I hadn't heard. That's something I haven't heard. And I find it really interesting, as later in the tonight, if we have time, or I have the strength, Leonora. There is a website dealing with Rashi, whose goal is to explain all of the Rashi comments everywhere as a rationalist approach. And Rashi, any Mekubal knows that in order to get closer to the Creator, it is not about rationalization. It is not about logic and understanding. It's about intuition. And in order for Rashi to write what he wrote, he had to be connected on that level that Abraham wrote in the Sefer Yetzirah, as I'm teaching on Monday nights, 7 o'clock LA time, that if you're interested, please join us. Yeshiva Studies. According to tradition, Rashi was first brought to learn Torah by his father on Shavuot Day at the age of 5. His father was his main Torah teacher until his death when Rashi was still a youth. At the age of 17, he married and soon after went to learn in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar in Worms, returning to his wife 3 times yearly for the days of awe, Passover and Shavuot, the high holidays at Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, the holiday of Passover, and the holiday of Shavuot. The 3 times that the Jewish people are told to appear in Jerusalem, Rashi was able to go and be with his wife. Zachu Baruch. Amazing, the legends and the reality. Yes, there are many, many people, many rabbis, many students of Torah who have this history of being separated from their wife when they study. But to go to the extent that he returned home at the holidays, I'm not ready to buy that one. When Rabbi Yaakov died in 1064, Rashi continued learning in Worms for another year in the yeshiva of his relative, Rabbi Isaac ben Eliezer Halevi, who was also chief rabbi of Worms. Then he moved to Mainz, where he studied under another of his relatives, Rabbi Isaac ben Yehuda, the rabbinic head of Mainz and one of the leading sages of the Lorraine region, which straddles France and Germany. Rashi's teachers were students of Rabbeinu Gershom and Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, leading Talmudists of the previous generation. From his teachers, Rashi imbibed the oral traditions pertaining to the Talmud as they had passed down for centuries, as well as an understanding of the Talmud's unique logic and form of argument. Rashi took concise, copious notes from what he learned in yeshiva, incorporating this material in his commentaries. Worms in Germany is a leading center up until the, the Crusades, which caused many million, well, thousands of deaths of Jewish people as the righteous Christians made their way to Jerusalem to take it away from the infidels, the Muslims. They had to cleanse themselves in the blood of the Jewish people. And so until the Crusades, Worms was a famous and strong location of learning. And that includes, I forget the Kabbalist who is associated with the 1100s, 1900s, 1000s. In his writings, all which may very well have been where Rashi got his aspect of the Zohar and his connection to the intuitive sense, to the schools of the prophetic knowledge. He returned to Troyes at the age of 25, after which time his mother died, and he was asked to join the Troyes Bet Din, the rabbinical court. He also began answering halakhic questions. Upon the death of the head of the Bet Din, Rabbi Zerach ben Avraham, Rashi assumed the court's leadership and answered hundreds of halakhic queries. In around 1070, he founded a yeshiva which attracted many disciples. It is thought by some that Rashi earned his living as a vintner, making wine, since Rashi shows an extensive knowledge of its utensils and processes. But there is no evidence of this. Although there are many legends about his travels, Rashi likely never went further than from Seine to the Rhine. The utmost limit of his travels were the yeshivas of Lorraine. In 1096, the People's Crusade, swept through the Lorraine, murdering 12,000 Jews and uprooting whole communities. Among those murders in Worms were the three sons of Rabbi Isaac ben Eliezer Halevi, Rashi's teacher. Rashi wrote several slichot, penitential poems, mourning the slaughter and the destruction of the region's great yeshivot. Seven of Rashi's slichot still exist, including Adonai Elohai Hatzavaot, which is recited on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, and Az Terem Nimtehu, which is recited on the fast of Gedalia. Most people don't know what the fast of Gedalia is all about. It's one of the four fast days in the Hebrew calendar. The fast of Gedalia, the fast of Yom Kippur, the fast of Esther, and the fast of Tisha B'Av. The fast of Gedalia is simple. After the destruction of the first temple, a king was appointed as a viceroy. One of the house of David was appointed as a viceroy to be the king as a representative of this foreign king, whoever destroyed the temple. And the Jewish people were incensed. There weren't that many of them left, but they still, it's time to hate anyway. What can I tell you? So, Gedalia was murdered by a Jewish man because we shouldn't follow what the Goyim, the non-Jews, teach the Jewish people to do. This is the idea. And there were other groups of righteous people who taught that this was God's plan. The temple was destroyed for our reasons, for our causes, and that this non-Jew appointing a king over us was part of the plan, part of the punishment, part of the effect. But some person felt so strongly that he assassinated the king Gedalia. And the horror of a Jew killing a Jew in the land of Israel affected the sages. And they declared a fast, not for that year, not for 10 years, not even for 100 years, a fast for all time, for us to realize how extensive our hatred for no reason is. The fast of Gedalia occurs on the third day of Tishrei. It was declared to be on Rosh Hashanah itself, to fast on that day. But for whatever reasons, the sages moved it to the third day. And for now, it's mentioned, but very few people participate in that fast. And to me, it's one of the most important fasts. It's one of the most important lessons to be learned. And I'm speaking about it now during the 3 weeks so that we understand that. Death and the burial site. Rashi died on July 13th, 1105, which was the 29th of Tammuz. He was 65 years old. He was buried in Troyes. The approximate location of the cemetery in which he was buried was recorded in the cemetery, which now lays under an open square in the city of Troyes. After this discovery, French Jews erected a large monument in the center of the square, a large black and white globe featuring a prominent Hebrew letter, Shin, presumably for Shlomo, Rashi's name. The granite base of the monument is engraved Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, commentator and guide. In 2005, Yisrael Meir Gabay erected an additional plaque at this site, marking the square as a burial ground. The plaque reads, "The place you are standing on is the cemetery of the town of Troyes. Many Rishonim are buried here, among them Rabbi Shlomo, known as Rashi the Holy. May his merit protect us." And I will add, Amen.
Amen.
The descendants, the main article of Rashi's descendants is he had three daughters, but no sons. There is a novel, historical novel, circulating in the last 2-3 years, written about, actually two novels, called Rashi's Daughter. And it describes how it's part of the education of the feminine, well, about the history of the Middle Ages in Judaism. But it is a historical novel, and there's a lot of liberties taken to it, so it cannot be seen as true history. The three daughters were named Miriam, Yocheved, and Rachel. All of them married Talmudic scholars. Legends exist that Rashi's daughters put on tefillin. While some women in medieval Ashkenaz did wear tefillin, there is no evidence that Rashi's daughters did so. Well, this brings me to modern day politics. And I don't normally discuss politics. I think it's a waste of time. But when it comes to Jewish politics, and the opinion of the rabbis, we need to discuss this. There is the wife of a famous Talmud, Mishnah Talmud, the early commentators, one of the students of the heretic who went with Rabbi Akiva into the Garden of Eden and came out a heretic because he saw good and evil being equal as part of his vision in heaven. And that was too much for him to think that there was two gods. So why should I just accept and not follow this religion? So he changed his ways. And Rabbi Meir would quote the heretic in the Talmud because, one, he was his teacher, and two, he always hoped he would return. And he constantly addressed his teacher and worked with his teacher to return, but he was never successful. His wife is named Bruria, and she is also quoted in the Talmud in many, many places. A very bright woman, Rabbi Meir and his wife would study together, unheard of in 2,000 years ago. Bruria, when her children died, two of them on the same day, so supposedly because of breaking Shabbat, washed their bodies, laid them on the bed, and kept the Shabbat, the joy of the Shabbat, the happiness of the Shabbat. And it wasn't until her husband came home at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night from the end of the Shabbat, from his prayers and his meetings with people and whatever else he was doing appropriately. When he came home, she asked him a question, a halakhic question. And she said, "If someone gave me something precious to guard and to keep, and I have lost that, and that person comes to reclaim it, Oh, it wasn't that you said they lost it. If that person comes to reclaim what he gave me to guard, must I return it to him? Now, it seems like a very simple question, and it is. And the answer is, of course, you can't steal. You must return it, and that's what Rabbi Meir said. And her answer to her husband after that was, of course you are right, my husband. And so the Creator has come to reclaim those two precious souls of our sons. And I gave them back to him willingly. Now this is the woman who laid tefillin. This is the woman who studied. This is the woman who lived in all of these times. And the commentaries over the centuries by the rabbis of women who lay tefillin has been that they have male souls. And to keep their correction, they need to lay tefillin. But it's not appropriate for every woman. And it's not appropriate for most women. Which brings us to today, about 1995 or thereabouts. Every Rosh Chodesh, there is a group of women referred to as the Women of the Wall who go to pray at the Western Wall. In the women's section, everything halakhically correct, running a minyan, reading from the Torah appropriately to women, not to men. Some of them wear tefillin. Some of them wear talitim. Every time for the last 16, 18 years, however long it's been, 20 years, I don't know, these women are accosted by religious people who tell them they cannot do this. And the women politely refer these men and women, because other women try and get them to stop, in really inappropriate ways. Fist fights, throwing chairs, other horrible methods. They refer them politely to their rabbis. And the rabbis say they are absolutely correct. They're entitled to wear the talit. They're entitled to wear the tefillin. They're entitled to read from the Torah. There is nothing they are doing that is halakhically correct, but they should resist, they should desist and stop out of modesty. This is the rabbis who should be bringing unity among the Jewish people, and they create separation. These are the rabbis who should know that women are growing, that the female is returning to the level of the son, the level of the male. And together we will grow seven times as this is accomplished. These are the end of days. These rabbis should not be doing this, in my opinion. And it bothers me tremendously. And where appropriate, I express it to my students. If you ever are interested, please look up the Women of the Wall. They need the support. They took the issue from the religious courts after the religious court ruled against them. They are not able to read the Torah on Rosh Chodesh. At the Western Wall, they are told to walk a number of steps underneath the wall, into the tunnels, where they have a beautiful location to pray. But they really would desire to pray at the Western Wall. And whenever they approach the Western Wall with their tefillin and with their talit, the last time it happened was, I believe, January of this year, or maybe off on the dates and the time. They go every month, but not every month do they wear tefillin at the Western Wall. But that month they chose to do so as a sign of disagreement. And so they were arrested. There was two women that were arrested by the Israeli police for doing what is appropriate in praying. An American jury stands up and say, what a travesty, the Orthodox is wrong, that we're right as conservatives and reform. And it's just all of this rabbinical story, as the Zohar teaches us. The rabbis of our generation have the frame of reference, the root of their soul comes from the Erev Rav. And they are being presented with opportunities to bring unity, and they are not. And this is the mistake, and they will eventually do it right, because that is why what the idea of the Erev Rav converting to Judaism was all about. When Moses allowed them to leave Egypt with the Jewish people, but not to enter the camp until they had reached the conversion point. Continuing with Rashi. Rashi had no sons, but his three daughters married Talmudic scholars. And legend exists that they wore tefillin. Rashi's middle daughter Miriam married Yudah ben Nathan, who completed the commentary on Talmud Makot, which Rashi was working on when he died. He made his original commentary on the Talmud, and then he revised it. Do you think he might have been revising it based on the Zohar? No, who knows? Their daughter Alvina was a learned woman whose customs served as the basis for later halakhic decisions. Their son Yom Tov later moved to Paris and he headed a yeshiva there, along with his brother Shimson and Eliezer. Rashi's oldest daughter, Yocheved, married Meir ben Shmuel. Their four sons were Shmuel, the Rashbam, Yitzhak, the Rivam, Jacob, the Rebbeinu Tam, as I mentioned earlier, and Shlomo, the grammarian, who were among the most prolific of the Ba'alei Tosafot, leading rabbinic authorities who wrote critical and explanatory glosses on the Talmud, which appear opposite Rashi's commentary on every page of the Talmud when it's printed. Yocheved's daughter Chana was a teacher of laws and customs relevant to women. Rashi's youngest daughter Rachel married and divorced Eliezer ben Shemaya. Rashi's commentary on the Tanakh, and especially his commentary on the Chumash, is the essential companion for any study of the Talmud at any level. Drawing on the breadth of Midrashic, Talmudic, and Agadic literature, I love this term, Agadic, nobody knows what it means. Agadic means the metaphoric stories. This is called the Agadic literature. And Rashi's comments are also on Agadic literature that we no longer have available to us, as well as his knowledge of grammar, halakha, and how things work. Rashi classifies the simple meaning of the text so that a bright child of five could understand it. At the same time, his commentary forms the foundation for some of the most profound legal analysis and mystical discourses that came after it. Scholars debate why Rashi chose a particular midrash to illustrate a point, or why he used certain words and phrases and not others. Rabbi Shtaur Zalman of Liadi wrote that Rashi's commentary on Torah is the wine of Torah. It opens the heart and uncovers one's essential love and fear of God. Scholars believe that Rashi's commentary on the Torah grew out of the lectures he gave to his students in his yeshiva and evolved with the questions and answers they raised on it. Rashi only completed this commentary in the last years of his life. It was immediately accepted as authoritative by all the Jewish communities, Ashkenazi and Sephardi alike. The first dated Hebrew printed books was Rashi's commentary on the Chumash, printed by, Abraham ben Gartone on Reggio di Cabria, Italy, in 1475. This version did not include the text of the Chumash itself. Rashi wrote commentaries on all the books of Tanakh, except Chronicles. Scholars believe that the commentary which appears under Rashi's names in those books were compiled by the students of Rabbi Sadia of the Rhine, who incorporated material from Rashi's yeshiva, Rashi's students, Rabbi Shemaya and Rabbi Yosef, edited the final commentary on the Torah. Some of their own notes and additions also made their way into the version we have today. Today, tens of thousands of men, women, and children study Chumash with Rashi as they review the Torah portion to be read in synagogue on the upcoming Shabbat. According to Halakha, a man may even study the Rashi on each Torah verse in fulfillment of the requirement to review the parasha twice with Targum, which normally refers to Targum Onkelos. This practice is called in Hebrew Shnayim Mikra V'chad Targum. Since it's of publications, Rashi's commentary on the Torah is standard in almost all Chumashim produced within the Orthodox Jewish community. Shnayim Mikra V'chad Targum means twice Torah, twice Chumash, once Targum. It is the halakha that during the week a man is to study the Chumash, the simple stories, the simple reading of the Hebrew, twice. And once he is to read the Aramaic version translation of that. That's the halakha. And there are many benefits, both halakhically and kabbalistically, as to why that should be done. But it is also good to read the Chumash in the language that you understand, along with the reading of the Hebrew and the Aramaic, or the scanning of those languages if you don't understand how to read them. Let me quickly scan this. The titles are the commentary on the Talmud, the response explaining his legacy, the super commentaries, and a discussion of Rashi's script. So you can see there is much to learn about Rashi. And as we know, the more that you learn about a tzaddik, the more connected you become to the light of this tzaddik. And that light then is a veil for you, a way of connecting to the Creator more easily. The Tzaddik opened the gate for all of us, for himself and for all of us. When we connect with his writings, when we connect with his teachings, when we connect with him as a human being and as a Tzaddik, we have a clearer connection to the higher levels of consciousness and ultimately to the Creator. Now I will give you a brief discussion of a website called Rashi Yomi. And I read this Rashi is a biblical commentary, a mission statement, who we are. Is a biblical commentary, the first commentator to provide phrase-by-phrase comments, provides explanations of meaning, grammar, similar verses, and philosophy. There, they then explain what they provide for people, and feel free to check out this site, rashiyomi.com. The uniqueness of our approach to Rashi is that we are skill-based. Each of our rules is a skill. Grammatical conjugation, lining up two verses, which can be mastered by anyone and applied. Comprehensive, we give 10 major rules and 30 sub-rules, which cover each and every Rashi. We are committed to explain all Rashis as reason-based. Intuitive, our rules are not ad hoc explanations, but intuitive rules. Rules used throughout literature. They enable mastery and explanation by anybody and comprehension of any Rashi. In essence, they are saying Rashi's commentary are very hard to understand. But here is our logical basis for why you should understand them easily. In essence, they are denying the Kabbalistic approach, the Kabbalistic connection to Rashi. And they're continuing the path of Western society and, unfortunately, the influence in the Jewish world that logic and reason is the way, is the path to follow. The way to understand everything is based on that level. And Rabbi, when the Abraham the Patriarch in his book, Sefer Yetzirah, and all of the history of the Kabbalists, give us a totally different direction and understanding. Yes, logic is beneficial, reasoning is beneficial, but there's another level that is equally, equally important, and that is intuition. That is a connection that cannot be described on the level of understanding. It's the level we refer to as chokmah, as wisdom. It's the understanding that when I need an answer, it appears in my mind. Where did it come from? I don't know. Who sent it to me? I picked it up out of the broadcast stations that are used by both the light and the negative side. Which side did it come from? That's up for me to determine based on what I know, how to determine that, and the actions that I did that day, and the day of the week, and so many other pieces of information that are used in determining, is this from the positive or the negative side of that broadcast station? Ultimately, we need to balance wisdom and understanding. And our generation, our society, for 400 or 500 years has gone down a path that has ignored the wisdom side and enhanced the rationalist and the understanding side. And it has led to a lot of chaos for no reason. I'm getting tired for the evening. It's been a while. I wish you all Shavua Tov. Have a good week. I am available to answer questions if you have any. Everyone is available to speak on the conference call and, of course, in the UVU call. Does anybody have any questions? Well, I remind you of the schedule for next week. Sunday morning, we have the class on the Aleph Bet. Sunday evening, let me take a step back. As you can see, I'm tired. 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Sunday, we have a class on the Aleph Bet. 10 p.m., we have a Rosh Chodesh connection. Sunday night is Rosh Chodesh, and it's an opportunity to take control of the energy of the month of Av. I invite you to come listen to learn about the month of Av. Monday night at 7 p.m., we have the second of our classes on the Sefer Yetzirah. 5 p.m. Monday, every Monday to Thursday at 5 p.m., we are studying the secrets of the Third Temple. Please join us. And that will be continuing to be studying Zohar in the future once we get back to Zohar.
Okay.
10 p.m. Tuesday is our scheduled class on Rabbi Ashlag's writings. Wednesday, 5 p.m. is Zohar, except when there's no Zohar, we're studying the Third Temple. 7 p.m. is the class on 10 luminous emanations. 10 p.m. is a class on the writings of Rabbi Brandwein. All of that is during the 3 weeks we stay focused on the Third Temple. Thursday, 5 p.m., we have the class on the Third Temple or the Zohar. And at 10 p.m., we have our weekly class on the Zohar. All of these classes you're all invited to. Please join us. One last time, any questions? Have a beautiful evening.
Rest well, Hanoi.
Thank you. You be well, Chris.